Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Tech Talk here on WINE Radio. My name is Anthony Sequeira, and we're thrilled that you're joining us for an hour-long session that we're going to do tonight on the core knowledge section of the CCIE route switch exam. Many of you are familiar with the core knowledge section, of course. That's why you're here. You've heard rumors about it. Maybe you have formed an opinion about it. You'd like to get more information. That's what we're going to be covering for the next hour. And this is part one of a series that we'll be doing on this new core knowledge section. I think a great place for us to get started in this broadcast is to review some facts about the new core knowledge section that we're going to face. Realize that you must complete this portion of the exam before you start your traditional configuration portion. And something we should point out is the fact that you are not going to have access to the doc CD in order to answer these questions. Here also, and I get this question a lot from my students, you're also not going to be able to go to the proctor for any type of guidance or clarification as you would with any other of the tasks that you must complete in the configuration portion of your lab exam. You're also going to have a total of 30 minutes to complete this section. Now here's the deal, you can finish early, and if you finish early, you're going to be able to jump right into your configuration portion. That means that you are going to get extra time for your configuration portion as a reward for finishing the core knowledge section early. I just want to caution you on this one. Some of these questions, and we'll discuss the types of questions that you can receive in the core knowledge section, some of these questions, they are going to be pretty tricky. So you're going to want to resist the temptation to knee-jerk and provide the very first answer that comes to your mind, because Cisco may have kind of laid that trap for you. The question author may have wanted you to go ahead and knee-jerk and write down the first thing that came to your mind, and that could really get you in trouble. So resist the temptation to go through this section too quickly. What I'm recommending that my students do is go ahead and, you know, really spend some time thinking about the question, maybe read it twice, type in their answer, read over their answer, go to the next question, do the same strategy for all the questions, and then go all the way back to the first question before you submit and just do one last sanity check that the question, your answer, by the way, was retained in the field properly and is going to be submitted properly, and just do one last sanity check before you submit. Since you could ruin your entire testing experience for the day by messing up this section, you really don't want to gloss over it and go through it too quickly. How many questions you're going to receive? Well, you're going to receive 4 questions via the computer, and you're going to type in short answers into the computer interface. It looks just like the core knowledge simulation interface that we have here at InterNetwork Expert. Notice the questions are not oral in nature. This rumor got started because originally when they beta tested this in China, it was an oral exam that you went through. They are no longer oral in nature. You are going to type in your responses. Cisco proctors tell us that the typical response is only going to require about 4 to 5 words at most. If you type in a novel, some of the proctors have indicated to our students that they will not even bother to read it. So obviously, don't type in anything more than a single paragraph. I would answer all questions with a single paragraph, no more. By the way, some of our students have reported getting 5 questions. Cisco tells us that if you get a 5th question, it's a beta question and will not count. Now you could miss 2 of the questions, but of course you don't know which one's the beta, so it's kind of tricky in its own right. So 4 or 5 questions. If you get 4 questions, you may only miss 1 of the questions. So if you get 4 questions, you don't have a beta question, and that means you can only miss 1 and pass this section. Spelling or grammar does not count against you. Now, with that said, you obviously have to be good enough with your spelling and grammar that the proctor who grades your core knowledge section knows what you're talking about. And it's interesting, while your configuration portion may be graded somewhere else in another time zone, and that's obviously going to happen, so if you're testing an RTP, it might be the Chinese proctors that grade your configuration portion, one thing that's interesting about the core knowledge section is it does appear to be graded locally. The proctors right there at your center are going to be doing your short answer questions. And one of the things we've had happen to students is while they were taking their configuration section, the proctor has walked up to them and actually asked them for some clarification on what they typed in. So if your spelling and grammar is really bad, don't be surprised if you get tapped on the shoulder by one of the proctors who's asking you what you meant with your particular response. So let's see. That answers another frequently asked question we get from our students. Is the responses that I type in, are they manually graded by a human, or is there a computer grading them by a script? The great news is they are manually graded. If you purchase an exam reread, are they going to regrade your question responses? And Cisco tells us yes on this one. It's really kind of funny. If you fail the core knowledge section, you don't get the option for a reread. Now, if you pass the core knowledge section and you fail the configuration portion, then you can regrade, and they're going to regrade your questions. This is really kind of funny. I don't know about you, but I would prefer they not look at my questions again. I pass them. I certainly don't want a second opinion on that. But apparently, from what we've learned from Cisco, that's exactly how it works. Let's see. A question that we get from students is, hey, in my configuration portion, could I return back to those short answer or open-ended questions? And unfortunately, the answer to that is no, because obviously then we could use the doc CD, and they don't allow us to use the doc CD to answer these questions. Now, after you take the core knowledge section and you move on to the configuration section, you will not get any type of score indication. You've got to pass this section, but you're not told whether you pass or fail, and you just go into your configuration section. Now, if you pass your CCIE lab exam, you're going to get an email telling you you passed. Hip, hip, hooray. You're going to get your CCIE number. You're going to be very excited. And all you know is that you passed the core knowledge, and you got enough points in the configuration section. That's it. You're not going to get any kind of score breakdown, and that's just as it was before. If you fail the core knowledge section, you will get a 0% in your score report for core knowledge, and then you will get your percentage breakdown for the configuration portion. So this is really pretty interesting, isn't it? And by the way, this would be an absolute nightmare if you saw this, I'm sure, but it's possible. You could get your score report back and you could be told that you failed, and you could have a 0% in the core knowledge, and you could have 100% in each of the configuration areas. Ouch. I'm going to repeat that. You could get your 0% for the core knowledge. By the way, the core knowledge is worth 21 points, and you could ace all of your configuration areas, get 100% in each of those sections. That would add up to 79, and you just failed your CCIE lab exam. Ouch. All right. Notice that, as you just learned, the configuration portion of your exam has been reduced to accommodate the 30 minutes and the points that are attributed to the core knowledge section. Notice you're still going to have a total of 8 hours that make up the open-ended questions and your configuration portion, and of course, you still get your delicious, delectable 30-minute lunch from Cisco. Obviously, another frequent question that I hear from my students involving this particular core knowledge section is typically something along the lines of, what types of questions can I expect? What are these questions like? How hard are they? What level are they? First of all, understand that the core knowledge questions can come from absolutely any section of the CCIE Route Switch lab blueprint. It is the lab blueprint that serves as the scope for these particular questions. And it's not just the topics we consider core, like switching and frame and IGPs. Don't confuse this with what we call core reachability tasks. The core knowledge section can draw questions from absolutely any topic on the blueprint. As a matter of fact, I like to direct my students to my expanded blueprint of topics that we feel are very possible for the lab exam. So you're going to use that expanded blueprint just like you've used it as a blueprint for your configuration portion. You're going to use that exact same blueprint for the core knowledge section. Now, the types of questions you receive, that's the scope of content. The types of questions you could receive, I like to categorize into five different types. The question type one, the one that kind of annoys me, and I'm sure it annoys a lot of other students, is the memorization type of questions. I don't like to memorize a lot. And that's because one of the things that you have access to is the doc CD. So why memorize if you have the doc CD at your fingertips? But unfortunately, for the core knowledge section, memorization is a component. And I guess I don't have that big a complaint about this as long as the memorization I'm doing is like worthwhile. For instance, one area that at this point we better memorize the values for would be administrative distance. And I guess I don't have that big of a problem with that, since we should be coming across administrative distance so frequently as we prep and as we practice for the CCIE lab exam. We should pretty much have these values memorized anyways. So a question sample might be something like, your Cisco's learned a prefix from RIP version 2, and your router's also learned a prefix from on-demand routing. Which will your router prefer and why? So that requires us to know, for the administrative distance values, what's better, RIP v2 or ODR? And the answer, of course, would be RIP v2. One of the things I always suggest for students with these memorization types of things, like I would memorize all of the administrative distance values, to do that, make good old-fashioned flashcards. Head to your local convenience store, department store, what have you, and probably not a department store. I think that's where we buy clothes, right? I don't know. You can tell I don't do a lot of shopping here in the Sakara household. But anyways, I would head out to the place where you can get good old-fashioned index cards, and I would make flashcards. I would really start building a library of flashcards for things that we know we have to memorize for something like the core knowledge section. This memorization that we now have to do, it's only going to help us when we get into the lab environment anyways. It's going to help build speed, because now I am going to memorize items that I previously would have been looking up in the doc CD. And when it comes to your lab exam, you're really, really pressed for time. So it's great to save like 10 seconds here, 20 seconds here, 30 seconds here. All those saved seconds start to add up to saved minutes, which start to accumulate into saved hours. And all of this works out really good when we're in that extreme time crunch of the CCIE lab exam. So the first question type, memorization type questions. Another question type we can expect to see are what I call trick questions. They're going to present something to you. Maybe it's debug output. Maybe it's show command output. And you might, again, knee-jerk, and you might say, oh, that's easy, it's this. And they were hoping that you would fall into that trap. So we'll watch out for trick questions. A great example that I like to give students is the show VTP status output. And you'd simply ask, what version of VTP is running? This is real deceptive, because it's really, really deceptive output. The very first field says VTP version, and will give you a 2, the default version that, you know, you might, or it's not the default version, actually, and that's the whole trap. It says VTP version 2, so you feel like, okay, well, obviously my switch is running a default version of 2, but that's not the case. What that first field was created to indicate is that your switch is VTP version 2 capable. You have to look further down in that output, and you'll see the VTP V2 mode field, and you'll notice that V2 mode is disabled by default. Silly little example, but it's definitely something that would be an example of a question that's there to trip you up, definitely to trick you. It looks easy. It might not be that easy. A third question type is the short answer on theory or technologies. So again, you might be shown particular output and asked a technology or theory-based question on that output. Notice it's a short answer that they're looking for. They might show you, for instance, the show IPv6 interface output and ask you, under the joined group addresses section, what is the purpose of the address you see there, FF02:1:FFEE:6A82? And you look at this, you see it starts with FF02, so you know it is an IPv6 multicast address. And then you see it has the last bit positions coordinate with your MAC address, so you realize, oh, this is the solicited node IPv6 address. And you could also go on to say that its purpose is to be used in the neighbor discovery process. So it's a short answer question on theory or technology, and guess what? This third type of core knowledge question, this is definitely the most common type that we're going to face in the exam. As a matter of fact, them calling this section open-ended questions, that's pretty deceiving because they're the least likely questions that you're going to get. Boy, it's too bad, too. Truly open-ended questions would be much easier for us. A true open-ended question might be, explain the differences between EIGRP and OSPF. See how easy that is? There's a lot of potentially accurate things that we could say there. If the questions were truly open-ended like that, they would be very easy. Most of them are going to be short answer, looking for very specific answers. Do you know why Cisco did this? Think about it. Why did Cisco do it this way? Well, if it's specific short answers that they're looking for, that's much easier for the proctors to grade. The proctors certainly don't want to get into this subjective grading of truly open-ended questions. They want to make it more specific. By the way, the proctors are all writing massive volumes of these questions. The idea here is they want to be retiring questions after they present them very, very rapidly. So if there was a breach of their database or some questions, you know, were dumped out onto the internet, those questions are going to be retired before anyone could make any good use of them. So they're all, the proctors all around the world are cranking out questions, and there's a good chance you can get a proctor that is not necessarily that strong in English that is composed a question. And it may be very vague or very difficult to interpret exactly what they're looking for. One of my students reported that, sure enough, he heard a proctor call over another proctor while he was taking his exam, and he heard the proctor say, "Hey, how would you interpret this question?" And sure enough, those proctors were looking at that core knowledge section and scratching their head going, "Boy, what exactly did the author indicate here?" Good news, obviously, is that we can miss one of these questions if it were so vague that we literally couldn't figure it out. Hopefully that's going to be the one we miss, and we're going to get the other three correct. A fourth type of question that I want you to be aware of, that you certainly could get, is the true open-ended question. Yeah, sure, you could get a truly open-ended question, and we want to be careful here. This is typically where we can get into a situation where it's really vague what they want. Maybe the question is something along the lines of, what's the impact on a device when you use the auto-secure feature on the Cisco router? Oh, gosh. Do they want me to go into a lot of detail here? Do they want me to bring up specifics or just stay real general? What's the impact on a device when you use the auto-secure feature? Well, if I got something real vague like this, I would say probably 2 to 3 sentences. Something like, well, the auto-secure feature allows us to disable common IP services that can be exploited for network attacks. The feature also enables IP services and features that defend against an attack. And the beauty of auto-secure is it's a single command. Notice I didn't write more than a paragraph there, but I really tried to cover my bases on what they might be looking for. The fifth type of question that we might encounter in the core knowledge section, I call the did you read your Cisco docs question type. It's purely just like out of the doc CD or out of more likely the technology documents that are available up in the support area. They might show you some output and just ask you, hey, based on this output, what features in use? Maybe it's the show IP rip database output and you see some rip entries in the database marked as permanent entries. Well, this would tell us that the IP rip triggered feature is in use. And what makes this tough is that, you know, we may have never seen this at the command line. We may have never turned on the IP rip triggered feature, or, well, that's highly unlikely, right? Because you're studying based on the expanded blueprint, so I would hope you've gone and you've truly implemented each one of the features. But here's the point. You may have done IP rip triggered, but there's a really good chance you never ran the show IP rip database command after you did it to see what those entries are going to be flagged as. See, there's a real good chance of that. And we can avoid this by really reading a lot of Cisco documentation. One of the things that students love about our core knowledge simulation is the links that we provide to questions you're not 100% on. So if you get a question and you're like, gosh, I don't know a lot about this feature, there's going to be a more information link available to you. And this is leading you to documents that Cisco uses to write these questions. We always want to be reading documents that Cisco uses in the creation of their questions. Lots of students also ask, how exactly are they going to study for this rather intimidating section? And what I really suggest that students do is go ahead and just follow our recommended study approach here at Internet Work Expert. You'll actually find a couple of different study approaches and plenty of study tips on our blog site, blog.internetworkexpert.com. Check out some of the posts by Peter. I think Peter Lapukov here at Internet Work Expert is a great person to use as kind of a mentor on how we should study, since Peter is really just amazing when it comes to studying. He passed an unbelievable number, I think it's 4 CCIE tracks in 18 months, and he's working on his PhD at the same time, I believe. So the guy really, really knows how to study. One of the things that I recommend you do, and it's following on Brian McGann and Brian Dennis's recommended study approach, is you really want to take a blueprint that you can trust, like our expanded blueprint that we publish on the blog, and you want to kind of, you know, be realistic. Let's say it's Friday night, and you're going to get a couple study hours in before you go out with friends. So maybe I'm going to study from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on a Friday evening. Then 9 p.m. I'm going to go out and blow off some steam. Great. So you've got yourself a 2-hour study window. I tried to keep my study windows to 2 to 3 hours at a minimum because you know how that goes. The time just flies. When you get all your resources together and you're all ready, you've already spent 45 minutes, it seems. So you want to give yourself at minimum 2 hours for a study session. And what you're going to do is you're going to pick your topic that you're going to explore, maybe partially, maybe fully in that 2-hour time. And you're going to go ahead and you're going to start with Google and you're going to start with Cisco independent documentation. Maybe it's RFCs. An example I give on the blog is maybe we're going to focus in on the RIP version 2 timers. So we're going to go and we're going to see what the RFCs had to see about these timers. And we're going to really study as much as we can from a Cisco independent frame point about these particular timers. Then, once we've done that, we're going to move to the Cisco documentation. This is critical, and we'll also be moving to the command line to see what Cisco may have done when it comes to implementing this feature. And sure enough, we're going to find out when we do that, in the case of the RIP timers, Cisco has added some that aren't in the RFC, like the hold down timer, and a brand new one, the sleep timer. You might be saying, sleep timer, I've never heard of it. Well, check it out at the command line. Do some context-sensitive help. You're going to run across this sleep timer, and this is to delay the triggered updates that RIP will implement. So this is the way we really beat up a particular topic. And notice you're going to be reading vendor-independent and vendor-specific documentation, and there's a good chance you're going to run across the material that the exam authors are going to use to create these core knowledge questions. As you're going through the vendor-independent and the Cisco-specific documentation, you're going to be writing your questions down on a legal pad. And yes, these questions are going to be posted on our forum at the IEOC, that's the Internet Expert Online Community, IEOC.com. You're going to post your questions in the appropriate forum up there so that you get all of these questions answered as you go through and you beat up this topic. You're also going to return to the command line, and if you don't have some sample lab tasks that involve the feature, you're going to go ahead and you're going to create your own. Create your own lab scenario to test this particular feature. Break the feature, then get it working again. Really explore every aspect of the particular feature that you're working on. You'll probably come up with some more questions, so you want to go ahead and post those as you use the command line. And then once you do all this, you can scratch that topic off and move on. If there was some particular points you think might be valid for memorization, go ahead and make your flashcards at this point for that particular topic, and you're obviously going to be returning to that those flashcards to review as you get ready for your exam day. So really what I'm suggesting to you here is you work in the core knowledge studying as you are studying for the configuration portion. I wouldn't separate the two. The only thing that I would be doing that would be pure core knowledge training would be using my flashcards and using a simulation product to see what areas I'm still weak in. And of course, we have a simulation product for you. It's the core knowledge simulation here at Internet Work Expert. You certainly don't have to use our product, though. You could literally turn to other resources like CCNP and CCIE level questions that you find in your Cisco press books, and they're going to certainly help to show you what your weaknesses are. We created the core knowledge simulation just as a very, very targeted simulation of the core knowledge section to find your weaknesses, but you could certainly rely on other resources in order to pinpoint your weaknesses. One of the resources that many, many students have enjoyed to find their weaknesses is my Cisco Press title, the CCIE Routing and Switching Flashcard and Exam Practice Pack. I do have some author copies of this that I can give to you if you haven't had a copy of this. Or well, now that I just said that, I'm sure I'm going to be running out here very shortly, but you could always email me and I'll try and get you an author copy of this kit. It's really sad because these things are going on the used market for as much as $100 a copy. It's ridiculous. Cisco Press no longer prints the CCIE Routing and Switching Flashcard and Exam Practice Pack that I wrote back in 2005 with my dear, dear friend in this industry, Kevin Wallace. Many of you have heard Kevin's classes. He's a voiceover IP guru. He's done a lot of great writing for Cisco Press, focused in the area of quality of service, where he is an absolute genius. So anyways, Kevin and I back in 2005 wrote this CCIE Routing and Switching Flashcard and Exam Practice Pack. And you know who was our technical reviewer? one of our two great technical reviewers. It was none other than Murillo Gorito, who now, of course, runs the route switch track for Cisco. So pretty funny. Murillo back then was our technical reviewer. And boy, did he use some of our flashcards for core knowledge questions? Maybe he did. Maybe he suggested that. But anyways, this document was written back in 2005, so a bunch of it is stale for our exam. As an example, it covers ISIS, and we know we would never, ever get core knowledge questions regarding intermediate system to intermediate system. One of the things that I'll be doing is sharing some of these flashcards with you in these core knowledge presentations here on WINE, and obviously I would omit any flashcards that deal with non-relevant materials. I mentioned my good friend Kevin Wallace. Let me see here. I want to make sure I direct you to his excellent website where he's got some great resources available. Let me just see if I can remember that URL off the top of my head. Yeah, here it is. Kevin's got a site promoting some of his excellent books, and also he's got a bunch of free materials up there to give away. Kevin's site can be found at VoIP, V-O-I-P, CertPrep.com. That's VoIP, CertPrep.com. Again, some great free resources up there for you, as well as a list of his recent publications that you will want to check out. All right, so let's go ahead and talk some technologies now. And we'll be doing this throughout a series of Tech Talks regarding the core knowledge section. Let's just give you a taste of how this is going to go. We're going to bring up some potential core knowledge areas for you, and we'll discuss the solutions to these core knowledge queries. Now, even though there's no section of the lab blueprint that talks about general networking theory, I definitely think that general networking theory, in fact, I know general networking theory type questions are relevant for the core knowledge section. Of course they are. This is, after all, core knowledge that we should have about all of the potential CCIE route switch topics. Some of these could be really, really tricky, and we had some fun writing tricky ones. Like, for instance, let me find a nice tricky one for you here. Oh, this is great. It looks so easy, but when you start thinking about it, it gets pretty darn difficult real quickly here and tricky. Name four distance vector routing protocols. Name four distance vector routing protocols. Okay, well, RIP version 1, RIP version 2, IGRP, Interior Gateway Routing Protocol. But now we get kind of stuck. At least I do. We got two versions of RIP, Interior Gateway Routing Protocol, but my goodness, what would a fourth distance vector routing protocol be? Well, you're probably going to want to indicate that it's an advanced distance vector protocol, but you could say EIGRP. In fact, you could also say BGP and just point out that this would be considered an advanced distance vector. We tend to categorize EIGRP as a hybrid routing protocol, possessing qualities of both link state and distance vector, and we tend to categorize BGP as a path vector protocol. But it would be valid to point them out here as a fourth option and just indicate they are definitely advanced distance vector in nature. How about naming three attributes typical of classic distance vector routing protocols? So what are attributes of our distance vector? Well, distance vector will tend to converge slower. We also know that distance vector routing protocols periodically broadcast routing tables. They periodically broadcast routing tables. Notice, periodic. In the case of RIP, we know by default every 30 seconds it's going to be broadcasting out to anyone that'll listen the routing table in its entirety. We know there are many loop prevention mechanisms that are needed with distance vector due to their routing by rumor nature. And we know the communication of routing table information is done with directly connected neighbors. Also, distance vector routing protocols define a finite hop count, and that's actually part of the loop prevention mechanisms, defining that finite hop count. Well, if these are attributes of our distance vector routing protocols, what are attributes of our link state routing protocols? Well, link state routing protocols tend to be more scalable, and some don't even have that hop count limitation that we have with distance vector. The convergence is going to tend to be much faster. We'll use multicast typically in order to disseminate the routing information. Updates can be triggered and non-periodic in nature. And because the routing protocol is more sophisticated and less prone to routing loops, we'll have fewer loop prevention mechanisms that will be required typically. We will flood link state information out to all of the devices in our routing domain, and local databases will be used to generate the best path information using the shortest path first algorithm. Link state routing protocols, as you know, tend to be hierarchical in nature, don't they? And this allows us to reduce the overhead as a result of this flooding of routing information. OSPF is the prime example here. We can create areas, and the link state databases will be identical, but only within these areas. And this dramatically enhances the scalability of these link state routing protocols. You know, when it comes to administrative distances, I already mentioned that we're going to want to make our flashcards and we're going to want to commit these to memory. Some are tough for me, I'll tell you right now. For instance, one of the ones I tend to struggle with a lot is, what's the administrative distance of a directly connected route versus a static route? It's pretty easy for me to get those confused. The administrative distance of a directly connected route is zero, and the administrative distance of a static route pointing to a next hop is one. Some of them are tough, too, because there's various administrative distances for the protocol. Like, we know that EIGRP routes have an administrative distance of 90, but, of course, EIGRP summary routes have a much, much better administrative distance of 5. And then we can contrast this to the administrative distance for EIGRP externals. So you got to spend quite a bit of time with these. I need flashcards. I'm not good at memorization, so I really need my flashcards to get those all sorted. This is a great one for Halloween. It's the floating static route. Floating. All right, that's just plain stupid. I apologize. Anyways, the floating static route, what is it? Describe the floating static route. Well, a floating static route is a static route that has an artificially high administrative distance. What you do is you take the static route, which would have an administrative distance of 0 or 1, and you artificially move it higher than your dynamic routing protocol in use. This is pretty clever. This makes the static route a backup to the dynamic routing protocol in use. So if our dynamic routing protocol has an administrative distance of 90, we'll go ahead and set the floating static route to an administrative distance of 91. And now if the EIGRP route were to be removed from the forwarding information base, we'll of course have the static route kick in. And that's the job and that's the description of our floating static route. Another very important general networking core knowledge kind of concept is split horizon. Split Horizon is a loop prevention mechanism that is going to be used, was invented for the problems that we can get into with distance vector first generation routing protocols. To prevent against routing loops, Split Horizon says that a device will not send an update out an interface where it has received that update from. So it only makes sense, right? If router A that we're neighboring with tells us about a prefix and it comes in our fast Ethernet 0/0 interface, we will not turn around and educate router A about that same prefix using that same interface. This is Split Horizon. Well, what if they asked you, what's an exception to the Split Horizon rule? Well, this is a fundamental concept called poison reverse. Poison reverse is an important exception to the Split Horizon rule for these protocols, and it says, look, sure, we won't send an update out an interface where that update was learned, with the exception of a poisoned update. If we know that a particular prefix is down, we want to educate everybody about that. We want to poison the metric and educate everyone that that route is down. And this is called a poisoned update. And it is an exception to the Split Horizon rule. We can send the update out the same interface because it is this poisoned update. Now, one of the things that we like to do in our networks is we love to engage in aggregation, also known, of course, as route summarization. Why might we engage in route summarization? We really strive to. In fact, variable length subnet masking really leads us to designs that encourage route summarization. But the question remains, why do we love this so much? What benefits do we get from it? Well, certainly route summarization reduces the size of our routing tables. Smaller routing tables are indeed going to require less memory on our routing devices. Certainly smaller routing tables are going to reduce the overhead that routers are going to require in order to perform lookups. And also, we have fewer routing updates because we hide details of subnet status. This is hugely important, and I find students often overlook this. When we do summarization, a great way that I use to describe this is we reduce the size of our convergence domains. We reduce the size of the convergence domain. When there is a change for a particular detailed subnet, that information, the update regarding that status change, can stay in a relatively small area of the network. It only has to propagate in a small area thanks to the summarization. So, summarization reduces the size of convergence domains. Summarization really leads to the enabling of the classless interdomain routing system that we know of today. How do our routers decide on the route that they are going to use to get to a particular destination? Well, remember, one of the things that is examined right away is administrative distance. We know that administrative distance will be checked if we're learning of a particular prefix from multiple routing protocols on the device. Now, let's say that we know how to get to the prefix, or we're seeing an advertisement for the prefix from EIGRP versus RIP version 2, and the router says, okay, it's definitely EIGRP that's going to win this battle of administrative distances, and of course I'm referring to EIGRP internal routes. So these prefixes win that battle. They get installed in the routing table. But wait a minute, now it's going to look at metric. It's going to say, all right, there's a couple of different EIGRP ways to get to this prefix. Now the router we'll look at metric. So initially, it was administrative distance that had the EIGRP win over the RIP. Now, if there's several ways to get there all by EIGRP, it will look at the metric for EIGRP. We know by default, the metric consists of an analysis of bandwidth and delay for EIGRP. So there's going to be a preferred way to get there, and that's going to go in the routing table. And another rule that you have to remember on route selection is the longest prefix match. So if we get into a situation where we have, let's say, the a route for a specific host address, a 32-bit host route, we have a route entry for the subnet, and then we have a summarized route entry, what would the router do? Well, it's always the longest match. So one thing that would always win out in this case would be the 32-bit host route. Yeah, absolutely. The 32-bit host route would win at that point due to the longest possible match of the subnet mask. Here's one for you, a detailed question on the concept of sliding windows within the TCP/IP infrastructure. Under this concept of sliding windows, who sets the window size? Is it the sender or the receiver? Well, with TCP/IP sliding windows, it's the receiver that's going to specify the current window size in each and every packet. The window, by the way, here refers to the number of data bytes that the sender is allowed to send before waiting for an acknowledgement. So that works kind of in reverse of how you think it might work. It's the receiver that specifies the current window size in each and every packet. By the way, speaking of these transmission control protocol communications, I've got another one for you. Of the sender or the receiver, who sets the SYN bit? Who sets the SYN, the SYN bit, in these communications? Well, the sender sets the SYN bit, and this is to indicate that the sender wants to communicate with the receiver. Notice the receiver will set the SYN bit in its SYN-ACK response to that initial SYN packet. Well, that should get us warmed up and raring to go and get us excited to study our CCIE route switch core knowledge. We'll be back very, very soon with a second part. We'll probably do many, many, many parts for this core knowledge preparation series here at WINE Radio. We sure do appreciate you stopping by today. Thanks so much for listening. And if you have comments, suggestions, musical or technical requests, anything at all that you want to let us know, please feel free to send that information to WINE Radio at INE.com.